Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 19th of November. You'll recall last week, and those of you who have heart disease or have had a heart attack or may have high cholesterol, or maybe if you have normal cholesterol, everybody has been paying attention to this study that suggested that millions more people could benefit from taking the cholesterol-lowering drugs known as statins, even if they had low cholesterol, because the drugs could significantly lower their risk of heart attacks, strokes, and death. This is stirring debate over who should take a blood test to check out CRP. We'll be talking about CRP and under what circumstances someone with high levels of that protein should be given a statin. There are people who are cautioning against testing people for the protein unless they have other risk factors. There are people who are concerning that are concerned about a healthy lifestyle and how important that may be. You have a very, very healthy lifestyle and normal cholesterol. Does it make any sense to take this statin? Well, we have a lot to talk about this hour. And our guest is Dr. Mark Hlatke. He is a professor of health research and policy and of medicine at Stanford University, wrote a recent editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine saying the aphorism, prevention is better than cure, makes perfect sense when applied to healthy habits like following a sensible diet, maintaining an ideal body weight, exercising regularly, and not smoking. But increasingly, prevention of cardiovascular disease is including a drug therapy, particularly statins, to lower cholesterol levels. He writes about this, and it's an article that is well worth reading in the New England Journal of Medicine. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We will have tons of them, I am sure. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Dr. Hlatke, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So who should take statins, sir?
Well, you know, I think drug therapy is one of the big reasons that we're doing so much better with a lot of diseases, including heart attacks. But, you know, all drugs have costs and adverse events. And I think as a general matter, you know, you should take it when you need it and not take it when you don't. And the biggest question is figuring out exactly when the benefits that you get from the treatment is worth it.
Mm-hmm. I can remember a few years ago, and I don't know if this was a result of a study. My memory is not serving me well, but I can remember having a guest on who said, within the next few years, we ought to just have statins in our drinking water. Everybody should benefit from these.
Well, you know, I've heard that said, and many people have said that these drugs are so safe and work so well that maybe, you know, just about everybody should be on them. And I think there's you know, that's an exaggeration, of course, but I think there's some interesting points about it. But, you know, I think we ought to step back and look at the fundamentals here. I mean, we've heard a lot about how in America today, we have an epidemic of obesity, and as a result, an epidemic of diabetes. We have kids who are developing these conditions that have never been seen before. We have people who are just physically inactive, and you know, our lifestyle is not exactly heart healthy in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions I ask is, you know, as a society, is our response to this epidemic of diabetes and overweight to put statins in the water? You know, I think we ought to go back to the root cause, not to treat the symptom.
Right. What was new about this study, it seems to me, was this testing for CRP.
Yes.
Can you talk about what that is?
Well, let me give you the bigger picture of this,
sure,
too. I mean, you know, coronary disease is multifactorial. It's not a simple thing like, you know, an infection where there's just a bacteria that causes it. So, you know, there's a lot of things that contribute to it, and what we find as physicians is that many people who come in and actually develop a heart attack don't seem to have a whole lot of very high numbers on their cholesterol or other things. You know, you look at them and you say, my goodness, you know, why did this happen? And in fact, half the people in the country might ultimately die of heart disease, both men and women. So, you know, people ought to be concerned about it. And the biggest question is, you know, can we look into the large numbers of people who have seemingly normal levels of cholesterol and other factors, and pick out the few who might ultimately develop heart attack. Now, the CRP test is an attempt to do that, and there's other kinds of tests that other people are developing, too. Some idea of getting a biomarker or looking at your genes or something like that. So the concept is a really important one. Can we look into the pool of people who seemingly have intermediate or low risk and pick out the people who really in that group might benefit from being treated? So from a conceptual level, this study is a very interesting one because it suggests that maybe you can do that by using this this CRP test. And CRP stands for C-reactive protein, and it's a marker of inflammation in the system. This is a high sensitivity assay, meaning it picks up little variations within what might be thought to be the normal range. You know, if you have an infection or something, your CRP level is very, very high. But we're talking about people who maybe have a something below 10, which would be the kind of you'd get a number above 10 if you had an infection or something. Mm-hmm. But if you are just walking around feeling healthy, your number shouldn't be that high. And so to reliably pick up variations in that range, this test is there. And the question is, well, why are people walking around with that elevated? And one of the hypotheses is that there's some inflammation within the blood vessels as a result that goes along with atherosclerosis in the blood vessels. So it may be a marker that there's a process going on in the blood vessels that might benefit from treatment. That was the hypothesis going into the study. And they thought, the authors, that by using this test, they might find people at more elevated risk and people who might benefit from treatment.
Mm-hmm. And that would be as a result, I'm trying to figure out what would cause that inflammation. That would be, you mentioned genetics. Would that be a genetic cause?
Probably not a genetic cause in the sense that there have been studies that looked at people who have genetic variants that just raise their CRP levels. And those people don't happen to have a higher risk of heart disease. So, you know, CRP is probably not the cause of the heart attack, which is different from the cholesterol level being elevated. I think the cholesterol level being elevated probably is the cause.
Mm-hmm.
But the inflammation is probably a marker, and we're not sure. It's maybe just a sign that things are happening inside the blood vessel. Whenever you have a cholesterol buildup in the blood vessel, it attracts cells. There's oxidation of the cholesterol. The blood vessel wall gets a little bit inflamed, and that may be just part of the process. And so this test may be showing us that under the surface there's this ongoing level of inflammation. And so the idea might be that the test is picking out people whose blood vessels are a little bit more diseased than others.
I see. And they stopped this study after a couple of years. I understand it was supposed to go 5 years because people were saying the results here were so dramatic that the number of heart attack strokes were cut so significantly, there was little doubt that being put on a statin was a prevention method.
Well, you know, one of the things that happens if you're doing a clinical trial is that they appoint an independent group of people, the Data Safety Monitoring Board, to watch the study to make sure that things are okay, independent of the investigators, independent of the sponsor. And that was done in this study, as it is in all major studies. And their primary duty is to pull the plug on the study if something bad is happening to people. So if there's some unexpected side effect or some big problem with the treatment, they need to stop it early. It's a more of a dilemma when it seems to be going really well, that maybe you're seeing such strong benefit of the treatment that you should stop because it's time to stop the study so everybody can get on treatment. Now, that's a much more of a judgment call, and some people have argued that the Data Safety Monitoring Board in Jupiter was a little too quick to pull the plug, in part because we don't have as fully developed data on the long-term safety of doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I sympathize for that Data Safety Monitoring Board. I've been on them myself, and it's hard. You know, you feel a real responsibility. So, you know, I think that that it's just an issue anytime you stop a study early because it looks so good is one of the things you're giving up is information about how things work in the longer run, because we only have 2 years' worth of data from the study instead of five.
And we've run into problems with quite a few drugs, maybe I'm overstating the case, that have been on the market for a while, and then all of a sudden we discover, uh-oh, got problems with this.
Yes, I think there's two things that happen with that. One is that sometimes drugs are have rare side effects. So, you know, for the one in a million type adverse event that's really horrible, even in a study the size of this one, which had 18,000 patients in it, you know, you're not going to see a one in a million event. You need to have millions treated. So very rare things don't come up during testing. The second thing is that when is this issue about how long you treat people. You know, if the study only goes on for 2 years, you don't see the bad things that happen at 8 years. And the final thing is that when things get out into regular practice, people who wouldn't have made it into the study get the drug. And so, you know, we doctors tend to broaden the criteria above, you know, beyond the narrow indications that were used in the study and use it in other kinds of people. And sometimes that's what gets everybody in trouble.
We have a ton of people who want to speak with you, so we are going to go to phone calls a little bit earlier than normal. Our guest is Dr. Mark Hlatke. He's a professor of health research and policy and of medicine at Stanford University. And let's start our calls with Dana from Oshkosh. Hi, Dana.
Hi. This seems like a finding that would greatly enlarge the number of people taking statins if it were put into effect. And you alluded to this earlier, but how can we be sure that this isn't just a profit margin issue for the drug companies that make and sell statins? What are the safeguards that were used to ensure that this is real data and not just a way to make more money?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Well, let me respond to your question in two ways. I think that's an extremely important point. The first thing I'd say is that, you know, clearly there's a profit motive involved, and no company would go to the trouble of developing a drug and bringing it to market if they weren't going to make some money from it. You know, I live here in Silicon Valley, and the fellow who moved next door to me is with the Tesla car company. And, you know, they are making a new kind of an electric car. These guys are in it for the money. They have to make money to sell their car. But how are we going to get, a development like that out there unless somebody's motivated to do it?
Mm-hmm.
So at some level, yes, I think we need to be healthily skeptical whenever anybody who has a profit motive is trying to sell us something. Just like when we go to the car dealership, we have to be, you know, say, well, you know, this guy's trying to sell me something. But, you know, sometimes we need a car. So at that level, I think it's good to be skeptical. The other thing to say is that I am reasonably convinced from the way that this study was done that the investigators, the sponsor didn't have a direct role in the actual analysis or interpretation of the study. They're going to take the results and trumpet them and advertise them, of course, but I don't think that they had a chance to micromanage or manipulate the data. I think the investigators do have ties to the drug industry, of course, and they may be putting a more positive spin on it than as a result. But the data are the data, and I think that they are pretty trustworthy. I don't think anybody went out and manipulated this.
Mm-hmm. What about the people they took as part of the studies? Did they make sure that people were of normal weight, they weren't overweight, they didn't smoke cigarettes? Were those factored into this?
Oh, my gosh. I think no. That's one of the big issues. You're talking about some of the key risk factors for heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that gets lost sometimes in the discussions about this is who do the results really apply to? And I think a couple of points should be made. The average age in this population was 66. The average body mass index, which is a measure of obesity, was 28.3. So most of the people, three-quarters of the people, were overweight, and perhaps 25% or 30% were frankly obese.
Oh, my.
15-16% of the patients smoked. Many of them have what's called metabolic syndrome. 40% of them do. Although nobody had frank diabetes when they went in, These were people who had many other risk factors for heart disease for the most part. I look at the study and I say, should it apply to me? I'm over 50 and I'm male, so that would technically make me a Jupiter candidate.
Mm-hmm.
But, the average age was 66. I'm much younger than that. You know, the average BMI is 28. Mine's about 21. I'm a skinny guy who exercises all the time and has no other risk factors and doesn't smoke and eats a good diet. And my LDL is pretty low.
Mm-hmm.
So were there a lot of people like me in Jupiter? Probably not
right.
in this study.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so – there's always a question, do the results apply to people like me? And I think for your listeners – one of the important things to point out is everybody in this study was at least 50 for men and at least 60 for women. So, for your younger listeners, there's nobody like them in the study.
Hmm. Let's go to Brian from Pewaukee. Hi, Brian. Hello, Brian. Are you there? Brian's not there. Let's go to Kathy from Stoughton. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there, Kathleen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a family nurse practitioner, so I preach prevention to my patients on a daily basis, of course, especially in heart disease. But I was at a conference about a month ago at Mayo Clinic, and they were talking actually about particle size and cholesterol. And people with, low to normal, maybe slightly elevated cholesterol, that it may be a particle size issue as opposed to just your typical total cholesterol, LDL, HDL, et cetera. And I was wondering if you knew anything about that and if you have done anything in California with regards to this trial about particle size and what you're treating with.
This is saying that, about cholesterol levels, we used to have just total cholesterol, and then we kind of broke it down into fractions, which was like so-called good cholesterol, HDL, and then the bad cholesterol, LDL. Which is a bit of a simplification, and the caller is talking about breaking that so-called bad cholesterol down even further into smaller fractions. I've heard a lot of discussions among experts in lipids, which I am not. I'm more of a clinical epidemiologist, about the relative value of different kinds of measures of your lipids and how they might contribute to your risk. And I don't think there's yet a consensus on that. One of the things that the trial should do, or I'd like to see them do, is to break down their results in that way. Could we break down the results within the levels of particle size? Now, I don't know if they did that. In any study, you have to make choices about what you can do, and you can't do everything. So I don't know if they have the results that way. The other side of it is that I would take away the message from the study that it's finding people at higher risk that's going to be helpful by whatever indication it is. So although the investigators used CRP as a way of finding higher risk patients within that pool of people who had LDL cholesterols or bad cholesterols below 130, there may be other ways to do it that would work equally well. We haven't proven that yet, but there may be such ways.
Thanks for your call. We'll pause for just a moment and return. Our guest this hour is Dr. Mark Lackey. He is a professor of health research and policy and of medicine at Stanford University. And we're looking at this major study on statins, which was released last week. And whenever there's a major study, a lot of people think they can benefit from this. And we're talking about whether or not statins should be used by people who have normal cholesterol levels, and welcoming your calls. Our number is 800. One line is open, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls now, let's go to Brian from Oconomowoc. Hi, Brian.
Hi, thank you. I apologize. Somehow we were disconnected.
Oh, okay.
I didn't catch it, but have you discussed how statins are so toxic that people require liver tests during and before administration, and the fact that medicine has become the third leading cause of death for us, and the fact that big medicine were given $50 billion 4 years ago to supplement its waning popularity?
What do you mean medicine has become the biggest cause of death?
third leading cause.
Third leading cause. In what way?
I would toxicity, malpractice, and a variety of other misinformed adventures that medicine has perpetrated over the past dozens of years.
Dr. Lackey.
Well, I don't know that I'd agree with the listener about the magnitude of the issue. I do think that it's always the case that drugs are powerful things, and that we should reserve using drugs for people who really need them and who get enough benefit from the treatment to warrant any risks that may be there and any costs that they may need to pay. I think that that's in part because we ought to not just always jump to using some medications when sometimes simpler measures might work. But that being said, I think that there's a lot of people who do need to be treated with drugs, and compared with some other drugs, I do think that statins have a pretty good safety record. If I could mention another drug that has been used for heart disease prevention, aspirin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've had aspirin around for over 100 years, and we understand it, and it clearly has adverse effects. It's practically free in terms of going to the drugstore and buying one of those big bottles of aspirin. But nevertheless, I think that people who might go on long-term aspirin therapy need to consider that maybe there's some adverse effects from taking even something as common and familiar as aspirin. So I think that you'll always have to kind of do this balancing. And one of the things that is also important about drug therapy is that we know what we know about some adverse effects, and then there's some other ones that might emerge over time that we don't yet know about, and that's another reason to be more conservative in terms of our indications.
And what is the correlation between taking statins and liver problems?
I think it's something that has been, you need to monitor.
Mm-hmm.
Your doctor will probably check those levels. It's not a huge problem, but at least one statin was taken off the market because of a liver issue. And it might be useful to say at this point that drugs, statins, any other drug, are aimed at certain targets within the body. So statin drugs are aimed at an enzyme that is used to produce cholesterol. So all of them interfere with that process, but they all have different chemical structures. And sometimes they have other kinds of effects, what doctors have called off-target effects. And things like this liver problem or muscle problems, which have been reported with statins, are probably off-target effects. They're probably not related to their effect from cholesterol on cholesterol metabolism, but due to something else. And so the possibility of these kind of collateral damage things always need to be considered. And sometimes different drugs have different levels of this problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's a long answer saying that, a statin drug years ago was taken off the market because of liver problems. And I think the regulators, the FDA, and other people concerned with safety are keeping a pretty close eye on that. And anyone who goes on a statin, your doctor's probably going to check for that.
Sure.
Generally, it's a pretty rare event.
Thanks for the call, Brian. Let's go to Michelle from Oconomowoc. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if, since there have been probably thousands of studies involving statin drugs, if you could refer me to any control group type study that shows that actually life expectancy is increased for those on statins. In other words, the statins may stop heart attacks but cause other deaths. So I'd like to know just overall if there are any studies that you could refer me to where the statin takers actually lived longer than the non-statin takers in that control group.
I think that's it's a good point. Is there evidence that people live longer as a result of this and not just, reducing deaths due to heart disease, but live longer overall? I think there's two things for you that could be looked at, and I don't have the references handy right now. But there was a big study, hundreds of thousands of patients have been treated with statins, by the way, in large clinical trials. And they did get together, a lot of the people who did these studies, and they pooled all of their data on over 90,000 patients from 14 studies of statins. And it was published in this medical journal called The Lancet back in 2005. And in that, they looked at the overall effect on survival, and these people did do better in terms of having a longer life expectancy. And I can't quote you exactly how much longer that was, but because I don't remember it off the hand. But it has been shown that the reduction in heart disease events did translate into longer life for those individuals. Even in the study that we're discussing today, the new one, the Jupiter study, they did show that the overall chance of dying was lower in the people treated with statins. Now, it wasn't a very big change in absolute terms, but it was there. Now, the final thing to say is that, you know, not everybody gets the same degree of benefit, that if you've already have heart disease, you've had a bypass or something, that individual will benefit from taking statins much more than someone who's 50 years old and has never had heart disease, especially, you know, a younger woman whose underlying risk is lower. So, you know, the degree of benefit, including extension of life, will vary among different patients, different individuals, which is why everyone should talk to their own personal physician to get, you know, an individual advice that's tailored to you and not just, you know, to everybody. You know, I don't think you'd, you know, everybody can say stop smoking. You know, I don't think anybody would go to their doctor and say, well, you know, for you it's okay.
Right.
You know, we'd say everybody should stop smoking. That's a public health message. But taking statins is an individual, personal decision that you need to weigh the benefits and risks for you personally.
But everybody should quit smoking.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it leads to heart problems. Thanks, Michelle, very much for your call. Let's go to Christine from Eau Claire. Hi, Christine.
Hi. I just was listening to the tail end of the response to the last lady as well. And one of the problems with that response is that it takes, you know, 10 seconds for a doctor to tell you to take a statin, but it takes a whole lot longer for doctors to explain to you why maybe your benefits, you won't necessarily see any benefits and they don't get reimbursed for that time, so they just put everybody on these drugs. But I was calling about the fact that really, in terms of public health benefits, there's only a very tiny minority of people who can benefit from this study besides the pharmaceutical companies. The actual people who can benefit from this are affluent people who already live the longest in any society anyway, because they're the only ones who are going to have access to the type of health care, insurance, and prescription coverage that's going to allow them to be on an expensive medication for decades, judging from what this study is trying to say.
This is what, about $100 a month I've read. Is that what you've read, Doctor?
Yes. You know, and one of the questions here, and it's a very big question, is would the effects that we're seeing using this expensive statin that's on patent right now, a branded one, Crestor, also have been seen if patients had taken one of the generic statins that, you know, you can, many drugstores now and large companies have been using this as kind of a loss leader, you know, come in for $4 a month and get your prescription filled type thing. So, you know, much more affordable. I think that the affordability issue is very important, both for individuals and for our society, to say, you know, can we afford to do this? Mm-hmm. But I think the caller is absolutely right that many times the people at highest cardiovascular risk may be in lower socioeconomic circumstances, may have difficult access to health care. And one of the challenges to the system that we have is how do we reach such individuals and do effective prevention? And some people would say, you know, we ought to be spending our resources not to go finding more and more people who ought to be on the drug, but do a better job at reaching the people who we already know need to be on them.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. Thanks, Christine, so much for your call. Gloria from Madison. Hi.
Hi. What I'm kind of interested in is I know when they do these studies, you know, you get your information on side effects. And with statins, you know, there's a very, they usually say there's a very small percentage of people who have muscle aches from taking the statins. Well, I've tried, you know, five different statins, and I always get muscle aches. And so when I talk to different people, you know, they say, I find out that I think there's a much larger number that probably didn't come out in the studies of side effects that occur that, you know, somehow I don't think they're recorded. Or are they recorded? What is the process for following up on these drugs and finding out what happens, you know, over time with a different population than was studied, you know, in the clinical trial.
And let me ask you, Gloria, are you off statins now because of that, or did you finally, you are?
Yes, and I'm actually taking an older drug, I think it's called Wellcol, and then also on a thing called Super Shots that you get in the grocery store that has plant sterols, and that seems to have helped my high LDL. But, you know, but before I even did this, I went through the whole thing, lost 20 pounds, changed my diet, exercised all the time, and it didn't, you know, still had high LDL. So I guess that's the question. You know, I've tried just about every kind, and I always end up with these muscle aches. And so, and I know that that's much more common. I think they say less than 1% or something like that, but I think it's much more common than that.
Dr. Leckie.
Well, I know that a lot of people have reported this, you know, and I've heard this from others. And one of the issues in the study is you know, how in any study is how well do you monitor for other kinds of things that might happen that maybe you weren't expecting to see. In the study that we're talking about today, this large trial called Jupiter, the investigators did report muscle weakness, stiffness, or pain. And they said that they found this in 16% of the people who got the statin and in 15.4% of people who were taking a placebo. Now, I don't know how they defined that, you know, and that would be an important thing to know whether kind of muscle aches is what they would call, you know, pain. Would that have met their definition? How you know, how broad were they in doing this? But the other thing to say is that sometimes people you know, will have things happen to them irrespective of whether they're on a drug or not. You know, I mean, I think that I've certainly had something where I you know, had some kind of a problem and I was taking if I was taking a drug, I'd say, well, it's a drug. And if I stopped the drug and it went away, I'd say, see? but I think the issue there is, you know, the listener who described this said, you know, this happened repeatedly with multiple drugs and multiple times. Now, that sounds much more likely that it is a drug side effect. But if it's a short-lived thing, you know, it may be that it's just kind of a coincidence because, you know, Lord knows as people get a little older, they do have aches and pains in their muscles. So, you know, it's depends on how much you need that drug. You know, if you're somebody who has heart disease, very serious heart disease, not the kind of person that was studied in the trial we're talking about, but people for whom there's general agreement, they really get a lot of benefit from taking a statin. You might be willing to put up with that a little more, or you might want to be absolutely sure that it's really there. Now, you know, if you're talking about prevention, you know, you know, you're feeling perfectly fine and you go on a drug and all of a sudden it makes you feel rotten, then, you know, you're much less likely to want to take that drug. So I think that a lot of people go off of these drugs over the long term. And that's true for, you know, statins. It's true for drugs for high blood pressure and other conditions.
Thank you very much, Gloria, for your call. Let's go next to Steve.
Can I make one
point? Oh, of course you can.
Before we go?
Yes.
One of the prior callers said something about, you know, the doctor doesn't have enough time to go over this with me. And I think the caller was really making an important point. And I just wanted to say that there are resources online that would allow you to calculate your own individual risk. You can go and calculate, go to the government. I don't have the website at my fingertips here, but it's called the Framingham Risk Score. And I'm sure the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute or the American Heart Association has online tools where you can put in your individual levels like my age, you know, my blood pressure, my level of cholesterol, and so on, and get some very individual risk assessments for you personally that would help inform that kind of thing.
Thanks for your call. Let's go to Steve from Oshkosh next, who has a question about Framingham, I think. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I think that was made a perfect lead-in for my question. I'm looking at a book called The Food Revolution by John Robbins from 2001. And on page 21, he quotes the director of the Framingham Heart Study, William Castelli, as saying, "We've never had a heart attack in Framingham in 35 years, and anyone who had a cholesterol below 150. And in this book, Robbins basically makes an argument for a completely vegetarian or vegan diet. And he's making the point that just having a cholesterol below 150 protects you from a heart attack. A total cholesterol.
Total cholesterol under 150.
Well, let me make two comments. One is that, you know, we talked about, quote, what's a normal cholesterol, unquote. And some would argue, I think as the author of that book, which I'm not familiar with the book, that, you know, the entire American diet, and in fact most Western diets, are not healthy at all. And most of our so-called normal levels of things like cholesterol and blood pressure and so on are in fact unhealthy. You know, they may be higher than they should be if we've gone back and, you know, we're eating like we ate back before industrialization, that, you know, our cholesterol levels would be much lower and we wouldn't have so many problems. And I think there's a lot to be said for that argument. And many people who, you know, do want to make a change in their diet to the kind of diet the listener described, and who can do it and who find it palatable and enjoyable, I think that's good. Many Americans can't go that far, me included, I guess. I think that you know, one of the questions is how to deal with where we are now. And, you know, I've argued forcefully that, you know, we shouldn't be turning to drugs as the first step at all. We should definitely look at our diets and other things first. You know, not everybody, there are some people who, despite doing the very best that they can, you know, can't reach those goals. You know, so in those cases, I think that if they really do need to get drug treatment, it may be a reasonable thought, but it shouldn't be the first thing that we do.
What about this below 150? I know that that's not as what the recommended. It's below 200 for American Heart Association. That seems very low to me. Do you think there are a lot of people in this country, a great percentage, who have overall cholesterol below 150?
I don't know that number off the top of my head. I don't think it's a very common level for people to have.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's one of the things about this study. They said, you know, a level of LDL bad cholesterol below 130, but you know, there's 129 is below 130, and so is 50.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that those are the same thing in terms of cardiovascular risk. So I'm trying to look in the paper here. The average person in this study that we're talking about had a cholesterol level, total cholesterol level of 186, below 200.
Mm.
And some of them had it as low as in the 160s. So, you know, I certainly know and respect Dr. Castelli, and I'm sure he knows his data better than anybody. But, you know, the Framingham also was only about 5,000 or 6,000 patients, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, not seeing something in 5,000 patients is not the same as, you know, not seeing it in a couple of hundred thousand or millions of patients.
More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Steve, thanks very much for your call. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to your phone calls. Our guest this hour is Dr. Mark Latke. He's professor of health research and policy and of medicine at Stanford University. And we go next to Sharon from Baraboo. Hi, Sharon.
Yes, I was wondering about the cholesterol ratio. From me personally, I have a very high HDL. Basically, my lips read 280-something and 150 to 170, and then my HDL is between 95 and 112. And when I do the ratio, I'm a very low-risk person. and I was wondering your opinion on that. I actually looked at Googled Mayo Clinic, and they said, as for looking at risk, the ratio works, but as treating the risk, they look at total cholesterol, which I didn't understand.
Well, you know, I think that there's sort of a practical and a theoretical response to your question. Personally, I think that, I get more information out of, a ratio has a numerator and a denominator. And I personally get more information about looking at those two numbers separately than by making a ratio. Now, I know many experts have said that the ratio is, they think, the most informative. But, you know, I personally don't find it as informative. You know, if somebody said, you know, my total cholesterol is, I'm going to make up some numbers so the math is easy. It's 200 and then it's 50. You know, it's 4 to 1. But if you make each one of those numbers, you know, if it was 400 and 100 for the numerator and denominator, you get the same ratio. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me to have a very different implication. So, you know, personally, I prefer to look at both of them together and not reduce it all necessarily to the ratio, because you can get the same ratio from lots of different numerators and denominators. Now, that being said, I think if you're talking to your doctor about it, that's the right thing to do, and everybody needs to individualize this.
And thanks for the call. Let's go next to Richard from Madison. Hi, Richard.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good. I've got a couple questions. I have tried to reduce my cholesterol, or have been trying to reduce it, using plant sterols and fish oil and soluble fiber. I had tried niacin, and it gave me hot flashes that were just intolerable. But my levels with exercise and these sterols went from, my total cholesterol was 259, it's now 219, and my LDL was 174, it's now 146. So it's still higher than it should be. My doctor said, well, we should give it another 3 months, and then if you can't get it down a little more, then we should talk about going to a statin of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
What's your opinion on using more natural, like these plant sterols, medications, I guess, or, you know, remedies than going on a statin for the rest of my life, basically?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the caller has described, you know, trying to do other things first, exercise, diet, and so on, that are very good steps, and I think that that's an important thing to do. I find that the distinction here sometimes between, a supplement or something that you can take from a health food store or something, and a drug is in many ways a little bit artificial. The statins were actually derived originally from a plant substance. They were naturally derived, and now they're manufactured, and everybody's tweaking the molecules. And many, many, many of our most powerful drugs originally appeared in nature. So to say that that just because there's a big difference between a drug and a naturally occurring substance that we might take as a supplement, I think that is, I wouldn't draw as sharp a distinction between them. I think that we can also get into some trouble from supplements and vitamins, as some of, the more recent studies on vitamins have shown. So I think in every case, there's a potential, two-edged sword with anything we do for that. Admittedly, the risks are lower with dietary means. Now, the other thing was that the caller was describing just cholesterol levels, and the other important thing to realize is that heart disease is caused by many factors, not just high lipids, and, the doctors will look at, and you can go online to the Framingham Risk Calculator and look at other factors like age, blood pressure levels, diabetes, smoking, obesity, your personal family
history, sure,
of heart trouble. All of those are contributing to the overall risk of the individual. So there's a context within which your cholesterol number needs to be interpreted. So, the very, very same number in a 55-year-old man who is overweight, and smokes and has a lot of other adverse factors, is a much more alarming thing than it would be in a 30-year-old woman who has none of those things.
Mm-hmm.
I also had an NMR lipoprofile test done, which I didn't really get a very good explanation from my doctor on what that was. How does that compare to the test that you were talking about earlier, that they based the study on the C, I forget what it was called.
CRP, is it? Yeah.
CRP, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I don't know the specifics of the test that the caller is mentioning, but I would say it's kind of the holy grail. Everybody's looking for it, is to say, you know, is there one specific molecule or something that we can measure that will tell us what the answer is? And I think it's a little bit more like, you know, the blind men and the elephant, where everybody is grabbing one aspect of this and saying, you know, it's the CRP or it's the subtraction,
right,
or it's
exactly
this or it's that.
Mm-hmm.
And we do not yet know the whole picture or the best way to do that. I think there's a lot of attempts to do that, and people are trying their best. But, you know, and this is the fundamental frustration for us in preventing heart disease, is can we pick out the people who actually are going to have the heart attack? Because many times, you know, we have people who come in who have a heart attack, and you know, a couple last week they looked fine, and everybody knows that's the way heart disease works, and it's the problem for us all, and we're all seeking this kind of, you know, silver bullet or the holy grail that's going to say, okay, how can we find out who it is that's really going to have the heart attack and get in there and prevent it just before it's going to happen.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Matt from Madison. Hello, Matt.
Good morning.
Hi.
I guess this kind of leads into the previous caller's question. I've been doing a lot of study because I have one uncle who died in his 30s of a heart attack and two in their 40s who have had multiple heart attacks. So it's in my family history. And in speaking with my doctor, I asked him about niacin, and he said that it is one of the best drugs or medicines to prevent atherosclerosis, but it's not marketed heavily because there's no money in it for drug companies. And he put me on it, and I've been on it for about 6 months, and I've had several tests just to measure my results, and I take 1.5 grams a day, and my HDL went from 32 to 54, which was a significant jump. And my LDL also dropped by over 20%. And he suggested that, you know, if I can get some additional exercise, I might not need to take a statin. And I wonder why we don't see more studies done at universities on drugs that are available cheaply to everybody and that have virtually no toxic side effect to the body other than annoying side effects like flushing.
Well, I think there were a number of complicated things in what you said. I think niacin is well recognized as something that does work. It's not as potent as statins are in terms of meaning. The levels for on average if over many, many people tend to be lowered more by a statin than they are by niacin. But one of the reasons is that you know, the caller has been perhaps you know, did not have a lot of effects from the niacin, or found that they were tolerable. Many people find them intolerable, and that's one of the problems with it, is that a lot of people just say, you know, this flushing's driving me crazy, and there are lots of there are ways to deal with that, to minimize that, and doctors can do that to some extent, partly from the formulation and how it's taken and so on. But nevertheless, there's a lot of people who say, you know, I've done my very best and it just doesn't work for me. And I think that may be the case for a lot of different drugs, is that, you know, maybe you try one and then you try another one and you find one that works for you, in terms of you know, whether it makes you feel bad or you have an adverse effect from taking that. So I do think that the niacin is well worth considering for people. It may not work for you, but it's worth trying. And I think absolutely that the caller is correct, that the system in the country is certainly that we rely on private industry to fund these large studies, and if there's not a commercial interest in the drug, often the studies that are needed don't get done.
Right.
And we do need more public financing from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute or other sources to look into things that may not have as much commercial potential, but nevertheless may be helpful.
We sure do. Thank you, Dr. Lackey, so much for being with us. An important hour. Thanks.
Well, my pleasure.
Our guest, Dr. Mark Latke. He's a professor of health research and policy and of medicine at Stanford University, looking at that major study looking at statins that was released last week and has created a lot of interest, a lot of people thinking maybe they should be on statins, and he's answering the question whether or not that is the case. So that's it for this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and to Mimi Notstein for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. News coming up and many more hours of great conversation ahead. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.